It's my pleasure to introduce the next speaker, who's Murdo Fraser, the Member of the Scottish Parliament for Mid Scotland and Fife. Murdo is also the convener of the Economy, Energy, and Tourism Committee of the Scottish Parliament. Murdo was first elected to the Scottish Parliament in 2001, and in 2011, when he was deputy leader of the Scottish Conservatives, he stood for the leadership of the party. And he stood on an extremely interesting and bold platform, namely to change the name and the identity of the Scottish Conservatives in an attempt to broaden the appeal of the party to the centre-right voters in Scotland, voters many of whom, I think it's fair to say, had lost touch with the Conservatives or had turned away from the Conservatives over the 1980s and 90s. Murdo was unsuccessful. He lost the leadership election to the present Conservative leader, Ruth Davidson, but he remains a very respected and always interesting voice in Scottish politics. He's been a consistent advocate of greater powers for the Scottish Parliament. He's written about this, and he's written on other topics close to his heart, such as football. So he's very well-rounded in every way. Not in every way. So I'll call upon Murdo now to talk about the possibilities of a federal UK.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Graham, for that introduction. Thank you for having me. And I'd like to thank Queen's University Belfast and the Political Studies Association for putting together this very timely event. It's not the first time I've worked with Graham. The last time we worked together, I contributed a chapter to a book he edited on another passion of mine, perhaps a shared passion, Rangers Football Club. Although I hope what's happened to that particular great institution in the intervening period is not a metaphor for the United Kingdom. Anybody from Scotland knows that the independence referendum question has become an all-consuming political debate. And in some ways this is not surprising, because what we're being asked in a little over 80 days, I think it's 85 days from now, is for people to make the most important political choice that anyone in Scotland will make probably in their lifetimes. And the debate has been lengthy, it's been noisy, and it's been heated. And I enjoyed listening to Leslie. Leslie and I were debating this very issue just a couple of weeks ago. I actually agree with quite a number of the points that Leslie made. I mean, I agree, for example, about the need for a restructuring of local government. I think the need to bring government closer to people is absolutely essential. I think we've completely lost the way in Scotland in that respect. And I agree too about the need for early intervention. And you know, the best way to tackle poverty is to intervene with youngsters ages 1 to 3. And ironically, the coalition government in Westminster has made a better fist of going down that road than the current Scottish government has. And where I would depart from Leslie's analysis is I think you could do these things now. You could do these things under the powers of devolution if you had the political will. And it's a bit of a cop-out to say we can only do these things if we have a yes vote in the referendum. I think, and also this is where I also agree with Leslie, I think the debate has been healthy. You know, we've had 2 years roughly of a debate around Scotland's future, lots of interesting visions. However the vote goes in September, I think that will be an enriching process. There'll be lots of ideas about how we take Scotland forward. But I do think we need to stop talking after the 18th of September about the Constitution and start talking about what we're actually going to do. To me, that's where we need to move on. And I think, too, there are parallels with the devolution debate. I can remember the run-up to the referendum in 1997 on devolution, where those campaigning for a Scottish Parliament were painting this picture that if only we had a Scottish Parliament, if only we had these powers devolved, we could do all these things differently. And you see parallels of that in the current debate, and I just wonder what's happened. You know, why was the creation of a devolved Scottish Parliament, which was held up to be so different, and offer all these opportunities turn out to be a disappointment for so many people. And I think, you know, in some ways it's a false dawn, a false promise we're being offered in terms of independence. I think, you know, we need to get on with tackling the real issues and using the powers we have rather than constantly agonising about what additional powers might be delivered. Having said that, I'm going to talk a bit this morning about what more powers we might have and how these might be used. But just to go back to the broader independence debate, I think there's roughly been a third of the Scottish population who are what I would call instinctive nationalists, in that they're people who just believe in their heart of hearts that Scotland should be an independent country and would be successful if it did so, and more successful than we currently are. And that group's always been about a third of the population, and it's always been, in my lifetime, in a minority. And the challenge for the Yes campaign has been to try and break out of this minority group and attract the views of those who don't share that instinctive view. And to do so, they really have to try and win the economic argument. And in this, so far, I don't think they've been making a lot of progress. And if you follow the debate, it's on the issue of economics that is principally being fought. Discussions around taxation, the currency, the regulatory environment for business, and EU membership. And I think the weakness for the Yes campaign proposition is that it's founded on assertion rather than fact, making it relatively easy for the other side to knock down their arguments. And I don't intend to say a lot more about the actual campaign this morning, but I'd be very happy to answer any questions later if there are specific points of interest. But the aspect of the debate that I think is more interesting for today is how Scotland will change, even in the event of a no vote. Because what we've seen over the past few months is the three unionist parties in Scotland, Labour, Conservative and Liberal Democrat, all coming forward with a further package of further devolution proposals in the event of a no vote. Now, these three sets of proposals are all different, but there is a relative degree of overlap. The most ambitious are from the Liberal Democrats, not surprisingly, based on their principle of federalism within the UK. The Conservative proposal is coming from a commission chaired by the unlikely radical Lord Strathclyde, former leader of the House of Lords, surprised many people insofar as they went further than many people thought. And these included the devolution of a number of taxes, including the entirety of income tax, which would mean that the Scottish Parliament would be responsible for raising, directly or indirectly, slightly more than 50% of the money it spends. In my view, this would be a major step forward in creating a more financially accountable institution. And the Labour proposals also focus on income tax, but are somewhat more modest than those put forward by the Conservatives. But notwithstanding this, there's sufficient overlap to make it clear what is likely to happen in the event of a no vote. A number of voices on the unionist side of the debate, such as Douglas Alexander, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, have called for a constitutional convention to be held after September to have all parties brought together to discuss a joint way forward, which would then be endorsed by the electorate of the rest of the United Kingdom in the general election of 2015. And it seems to me this is a sensible way forward, and would also allow the SNP, who for understandable reasons do not want to engage in this particular debate at the present time, to then to become engaged in that process. So things are going to change. But what I think is missing from the debate so far is how the changes in Scotland will impact on the rest of the United Kingdom. And it's really this issue I'd like to address in more detail. Because what the independence referendum has revealed, if anything, is that Scotland is a deeply divided country when it comes to our constitutional future. The majority, it seems, support Scotland continuing as part of the United Kingdom, whilst a vocal minority support independence. Amongst those supporting Scotland remaining in the UK, a sizeable proportion, perhaps more than half, almost certainly more than half, believe that there should be additional powers devolved. Even amongst those supporting independence, there are some who probably would be satisfied with some degree of further devolution. And a referendum with a binary yes-no question was always going to polarise opinion. But is there really no common ground between these two different stances? Is there no alternative around which a clear majority of the Scottish people could coalesce? I would suggest that federalism within the UK, if it were workable and could be achieved, is a solution which could unite both unionists and many nationalists and provide a secure framework for the future. So what is federalism? Well, at its core, it's the belief that sovereignty is entrenched at each layer of government, as opposed to the current UK constitutional position, whereby all sovereignty rests at Westminster. Now, while we do have devolution to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, these devolved institutions derive their authority from Westminster, and technically could be abolished at any point by an act of the Westminster Parliament. As Enoch Powell famously stated, power devolved is power retained. Now, the Scottish writer and commentator David Torrance points out in his recent book that the early 20th century was the period when UK federalism reached its high watermark, with a cabinet subcommittee tasked with drafting a bill for a federal UK in an attempt to deal with the Irish question. The Conservative Party campaign guide for the 1950 general election compares the position of Stormont vis-à-vis the UK with, and I quote, the federal structures of Canada and Australia, where the separate states possess considerable powers of local autonomy, but are represented in the central Dominion Parliament, which retains the control of essential and major matters. Now, the paradox was, of course, that this federal arrangement was deemed appropriate for Northern Ireland, but not for Scotland or Wales, or indeed parts of England. And it was left to the Liberal Party to try and take forward federal thinking, which they did, to be honest, without much success. Now, despite the historic aversion of British politicians to a federal system here, that has not stopped Britain exporting federalism around the world. The federal constitutions of Australia and Canada were a gift of the Westminster government, as indeed was to a large extent the current federal constitution of Germany. Under these systems, each tier of government has responsibility substantially for raising the money it spends, although there will always be a degree of cross-subsidy whereby the stronger states or region support the weaker in order to provide a sense of cohesion and shared risk and reward. And with a federal system, there is no sense that the federal parliament can override the decisions taken at the state or regional level. The balance of power and responsibility is clear and of necessity documented in a written constitution. In the event of disputes, then an independent constitutional court will be the arbiter. So how could we see a federal UK working? Well, leaving aside the constitutional nicety of devolution being power temporarily loaned by Westminster, there are aspects of the UK's devolved journey that mirror federalism, at least in relation to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. So the current devolved Scottish Parliament operates more or less along the lines of a state legislature in many federal systems, the significant difference being the lack of tax-varying powers. To an extent, but only that, this will be rectified when the tax-varying powers in the Scotland Act come fully into force in 2015. Therefore, to create something akin to a federal system for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland would therefore be comparatively straightforward. It would involve entrenching in the written constitution the existence and sovereignty of these institutions, moving some way towards equalising their powers and providing greater financial responsibility. In line with federal systems across the world, this would mean the Scottish Parliament, and for that matter the Welsh and Northern Irish Assemblies, raising somewhere between 50 and 70% of the money they have the responsibility for spending, with the balance coming in some form of equalising grants based on the Barnett formula or an updated needs-based version from Westminster. Lord Strathclyde's proposals for the Conservative Party in the event of a no vote in September's referendum would deliver just such a set of arrangements. The challenge to the federalist argument in the UK context has never really been about what do we do about Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland. It is and always has been this thorny question, what on earth do we do about England? Now, it goes without saying that the question of how England should be governed is a matter for the English people themselves and not something that a Scot should dictate. There already exists a campaign for an English Parliament, and beyond that there is a vigorous lobby even within Westminster at present to deal with the West Lothian question, to which a satisfactory answer is still awaited. It is certainly perfectly possible in theory to create an English Parliament with powers akin to Holyrood. This need not require a separate institution with a whole suite of new politicians. It could comparatively easily be achieved by taking the existing members of the House of Commons, who sit for English constituencies, and constituting them into a de facto English Parliament, which could, for example, sit on certain days of the week. A new executive would have to be formed with an English First Minister and Cabinet exercising devolved powers. Now, whilst all this works in theory, the practical implications are problematic. There is no working federal structure in the world I'm aware of where one state unit has 85% of the total population and the overwhelming share of the wealth. Although the US Federation has states with widely varying populations, from Alaska with fewer than 1 million people to California with more than 35 million. Moreover, given the size and wealth of England, the English First Minister would in practice be as powerful, if not more powerful, a politician than the UK Prime Minister, if indeed they were different people. Within a federal UK Parliament, the interests of England would overwhelm those of the other federated partners. So it's hardly a recipe for a lasting, stable and successful partnership. So I think it's reasonable to conclude that if federalism is to work within the UK, it cannot do so on the basis of England as a single unit. And the problem that immediately arises is that, until now, there has been little appetite within England for the sort of regional government that would be required to balance a Scottish Parliament or a Welsh or Northern Irish Assembly. And as you'll remember, when John Prescott in the last Labour government tried to establish a regional assembly in the north of England, there was very little public support. But I'm not sure that means that the game is lost, because I think there are hints that the mood, even with England, is changing. Given the concern within the north about being left behind as Scotland gets more and more power, I suspect if there were today a credible set of proposals for regional government, then the result of the referendum there might be very different from what it was in 2004, when, as you might remember, the North East voted by a margin of 78% to 22% against at that point. And various politicians, among them the UK Business Secretary Vince Cable, have expressed concern about the continued centralisation of power within England, although we should not be surprised at this coming from a Liberal Democrat whose party has a historic commitment to federalism. But perhaps a more interesting development has been in London, where the establishment of the London Assembly and the position of the elected mayor, both seen as radical innovations when they were first proposed, are now overwhelmingly accepted. Indeed, the current incumbent of the mayoral position, Boris Johnson, has been energetically campaigning for further devolution to London, including of legislative powers. And it would indeed be an irony if it were the capital itself which were to lead the way in creating a more federal England. And there must be other regions looking at what has been achieved in London and concerned that they are in danger of being left behind. Now, the UK Cities Minister, Greg Barker, I know, was very interested in pursuing this agenda. And only on Monday, George Osborne was speaking, talking about the need for serious devolution of budgets and powers to English cities. So you can envisage a network of strong cities or city regions emerging to which powers could be devolved. And then you can add into the mix historic counties with a strong local identity, such as Yorkshire or Cornwall. And you then have areas such as the North East or North West or the East Midlands, which already have a coherent regional identity. And very quickly, the map of England is filled up with a patchwork of local units, maybe not identical in geographic size, population or wealth, but all having an identifiable local focus. Now, it's difficult for the moment, at least, to envisage full legislative powers being devolved to all such local structures in the same way as they've been to Scotland. But it's quite possible to sketch out the start of what could develop in time into federal substates. Transplanting a US, Canadian, American or even German model of federalism onto the UK is never going to be a simple or straightforward process. But the history of development of the UK Constitution has been one of a series of messy but working compromises, which in theory make little sense, but in practice hang together very well. There might just be the signs of a very British solution to a historic problem. And what the sort of federal structure proposed would also allow us to do is tackle two other thorny and potentially irresolvable constitutional problems. Firstly, the West Lothian question, and secondly, reform of the House of Lords. Because with a federal UK Parliament and power passed down to local and regional governments, the voting rights of all Westminster MPs could remain exactly the same, as they would all be voting on the same range of issues as affected their constituents. The added bonus would be that there would be a strong argument for reducing the size of the House of Commons substantially. In relation to the House of Lords, a new federal UK structure would allow the existing upper house to be replaced with a Senate. Indeed, I saw Gordon Brown proposing just this last week, providing equal representation for each federated part of the United Kingdom, thus providing the requisite political balance, and an appropriate counterweight to the House of Commons with its own electoral mandate. And if that makes the elected UK government having to work harder to get its legislation through and take greater account of all geographic interests across the country, then so much the better. So is federalism the answer? Well, as I said earlier, there's a growing view in many quarters that even with the advent of devolution, the UK is too centralised a state. And such a view is now probably more strongly held in those parts of England furthest from London. A federal UK is a response to legitimate demands from communities across the UK for a greater say. And the beauty of a federal structure is that it solves a number of problems in one go. It deals with the democratic deficit issue, affecting not just Scotland and Wales, but other parts of England. It deals with the West Lothian question and concerns over the Barnett formula, and makes more transparent funding arrangements for different parts of the UK. And it allows us to move on with reform of the House of Lords into an effective second chamber, providing an appropriate constitutional balance to the Commons. Crucially, federalism provides the potential for a permanent, lasting and stable political framework for the UK. It is one of the weaknesses of devolution that it is, as the former Secretary of State for Wales, Ron Davis, famously said, a process, not an event. And this has led us to regularly revisiting the devolution settlement for Scotland in the few years that the Scottish Parliament has existed. With the Calman Commission and then the Scotland Act 2012, and now with new commissions established to consider further devolution in the event of a no vote in September's referendum. For those of a unionist persuasion, it leaves many wondering where and when will this process end, if ever. In contrast, federalism is very much an event, not a process. Once established and codified in a written constitution, changing the ground rules in any direction would be extremely difficult, and therefore a more stable constitutional framework for the UK established. From a political perspective, as the Welsh Conservative David Melding has argued, a federal system has the prospect of attracting the support of both unionists and nationalists. Unionists might prefer a system where Westminster continued to be sovereign, but they will see in federalism a way of providing stability and balance to a currently unstable and unbalanced set of arrangements. For nationalists, while federalism clearly secures Scotland's place in the UK, it nevertheless entrenches in law the existence of the Scottish Parliament, and of course involves the devolution of substantial additional financial powers from those currently existing. And undoubtedly there are many currently contemplating a yes vote in the referendum who might well be satisfied with such an arrangement. Opinion polls currently suggest there's likely to be a no vote in the referendum in September, albeit not by a huge margin. No one credibly believes that if this is the outcome of the vote, that will be the end of Scotland's constitutional debate, because we will then have two alternatives as a nation. The first, which no doubt some nationalists will enthusiastically adopt, is to set our sights upon the next referendum, be that 15, 20 or 25 years into the future, and start upon the Sisyphean task of endlessly rehearsing the same arguments that we've been fighting over for the last few years. I don't view that as a very attractive prospect. The second, and to be much more appealing prospect, is to look at how we achieve a new constitutional settlement that both secures Scotland's place in the United Kingdom, yet satisfies legitimate aspiration for more local power, which a majority of Scots undoubtedly want to see. If the second route is the more attractive one, and I have no doubt it is, then a federal UK provides the answer. It is, as David Torrance has written, the only constitutional model that would give adequate and coherent expression to the delightfully messy status quo. Now, there are substantial practical difficulties to be overcome, not least persuading the good people of England that this is the route they want to go down. Before even contemplating this, they would want to know that there would not be a substantial multiplication of existing numbers of politicians and expenditure in government. And that would involve readdressing both the size and composition of the current Houses of Commons and Lords, and looking again at the system of local government. Any solution is unlikely to be simple and neat, but British reforms have a history of being messy compromises and yet still managing to do the job. So in conclusion, I think federalism has the potential to be the common ground on which we can unite a divided nation after September's vote and move forward. It is an idea, according to David Torrance, whose time has finally come, and one attracting more interest. In the last few months, two books have been published promoting federalism in a UK context. What we now need is politicians of vision at Westminster who are prepared to take this initiative forward. I think it is in the interest not just of Scotland, but the whole of the UK that they do so. Thank you very much.